You are listening to the Brennan Center Podcast. Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.
Here to moderate a session on Evenwell versus Abbott. In our roundup this morning on the blog, we had a link to a paper by Andrew Grossman of the Heritage Foundation, who called this perhaps the most consequential case of the term, and in a term that includes abortion, the birth control mandate, affirmative action, and possibly the Obama administration's immigration policy, that's a pretty big deal. But my panelists are nodding. They agree, although I imagine they probably disagree with Andrew Grossman on exactly how the case should turn out. So let me just tell you, we're going to spend about 35 or 45 minutes today listening to our expert panelists, and then we will have time for questions. I'm going to start with Nina Perales, who is the Vice President of Litigation for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Her specialty is voting rights, and she has successfully litigated statewide redistricting cases in Texas and Arizona. She also successfully argued Lulac versus Perry, which was the challenge to the 2003 Texas congressional redistricting in the Supreme Court. And then we're going to move on to Michael Lee, who's counsel at the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Before he joined the Brennan Center, he practiced law for 10 years at Baker Botts LLP in Dallas. He is also the author of a widely cited blog on Texas redistricting and election law issues that the New York Times has called indispensable. Mm-hmm. And then we will be joined by Vincent Baraba, who served as the director of the Census Bureau from 1973 to 1976, and again from 1979 to 1981. He's currently a commissioner on the California Citizens Redistricting Commission and the chair of the State of the USA, which is a nonprofit that provides information about changing societal, environmental, and economic conditions to the US. And we're gonna start with Nina, who's gonna give us focus primarily on Texas itself and then sort of widen the lens by turning to Michael, who will talk about the case and its broader impact across the country. And then we're going to turn to Vince, who will talk about his experiences as the director of the Census Bureau and how that plays into this case. So let's start with Nina and how this case is going to affect elected representatives.
Thank you very much. And my apologies to the people I can already see here who have heard my rap on Evenwell before. This case comes out of Texas. But as you know, because it's pending in the U.S. Supreme Court, the decision will apply nationwide. The case ostensibly challenges the Texas redistricting plan for its state Senate. And the reason that this case is being described as the most consequential or one of the most consequential of the term is that it attacks a principle of representation and our idea of democracy that's so fundamental that most of us haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it. So I'll give you an example from the period in history before the Supreme Court started deciding its one person, one vote cases in the 1960s. Imagine the state that you live in. If you live in the district, imagine some other state. And imagine that your state assembly is made up of one person from each county, because it made eminent sense to many states that there should be one representative for each county. The first thing you're thinking of is, goodness me, we've got some counties that have huge cities in them. And that would be like a whole bunch of people with only one representative. And then there'd be some rural county out there that had more cows than people, and they would also get one representative. And that just seemed so unbelievably unfair and, in fact, unconstitutional that the Supreme Court overturned those types of redistricting plans or representation plans and announced instead the rule that has led all states, with very few exceptions, to put an equal number of people in each district that they're drawing, whether it's state senate, lower chamber, school district, city council. We've been living with this rule of equal population in districts for so long, we don't even think about it anymore. It's that deeply embedded in our consciousness. And it's that rule that the Evenwell case seeks to overturn, creating chaos throughout the country because so many of our representation districts or our election districts would have to be redrawn as a result. I'll give you two examples of the type of upheaval that would be caused by a ruling such as the one sought by Ms. Evanwell. And what she's asking for is that districts not contain equal numbers of people. She's asking that districts contain equal number of voters, and thus rendering invisible anybody who is a person but not a voter. The largest group in the United States of people who are not voters are children. By many orders of magnitude, it's children. And children are not always evenly distributed throughout our communities. I'll give you some examples from Texas, which is the state where I happen to live, which is great because all these great, amazing Supreme Court cases come up out of Texas, including Fisher, which is being argued the day after, which we could all talk about endlessly. But I'll give you an example. Austin, Texas, great university town, and South by Southwest, music, art, film, lots of hipsters without kids, right? So there's actually a very light concentration of children in Austin and in Travis County, where Austin is located. There are other parts of Texas, heavily conservative counties in the suburbs outside of Dallas and Houston, that have tons of kids in them, right? All of whom would be invisible for the purpose of drawing redistricting lines. And then also, if you start looking towards South Texas, where the Latino population becomes greater, more children, because Latinos have more children in their families typically than non-Latinos in Texas. And in fact, our age structure skews quite young. The majority of K through 12 students, for example, today in Texas are Latino, even though we're only 38% of the population. So by rendering children invisible in redistricting, as well as much smaller groups of other non-voters, including immigrants who are not yet citizens, those who don't have the franchise because of criminal conviction or mental lack of capacity, once you sort of invisibilize all of these folks, you get two really huge impacts. One is that districts themselves start to vary enormously in the number of people they have in them. When you start equalizing the number of voters, you get enormous inequalities in the number of people. So, for example, in the Texas Senate redistricting plan, there would be a district in Houston with more than 1 million people in it, and then another district in Northeast Texas that would probably only have 700,000 people in it. So if you imagine yourself as a state senator in Texas, which district would you prefer to represent? The one with 1 million people in it calling you for help and representation and to carry their issues forward, or the one with 700,000 people in it? Also, which district would you rather live in? The one that has 1 million people, where you have so little access to your representative and so little ability on the part of your representative to represent you, or would you rather be in one of those districts that has fewer people in it? So one impact, big districts and small districts. The other impact is that districts themselves would physically relocate from one part of the state to another. We'll go back to Houston. Right now, Harris County has 24 state rep seats in it. If Ms. Evanwell were to win a ruling saying that we can only count citizen voting age population when we draw district lines, Harris County would lose two of its state representative seats out into another part of Texas. The delegation would be smaller, and the regions of Texas would start to lose representation. The panhandle would lose representation. South Texas would lose multiple state representative seats, and an entire state Senate seat would disappear. And this has enormous policy implications, much more profound than how many districts ought to be drawn under the Voting Rights Act, much more profound than the usual frame people tend to see these in, the people with the red t-shirts and the people with the blue t-shirts. This has an extremely chaotic effect on representation and districting, and far beyond Texas as well. Thank you.
And so you've touched on this a little bit, Nina. What would the effect be on, in your view, on the Latino community in particular in Texas?
Well, I'm actually really glad this case came from Texas, because the Supreme Court has been following the efforts of Latinos in Texas to have an equal shot at participating in elections for many years. White versus Register back in 1973, the Supreme Court found discrimination against Latinos. Every redistricting plan we've had since the 1970s has been invalidated under one part of the Voting Rights Act or another. And then finally, less than 10 years ago, in LULAC versus Perry, the Supreme Court found discrimination against Latinos in the Texas Congressional Redistricting Plan. The Supreme Court knows very well the long, hard road that Latinos have walked in order to get closer to fair representation in our redistricting plans. As Nate Persily so aptly said, this case, if Ms. Evanwell wins one of these crazy metrics that she's advancing, would cut Latinos off at the knees, primarily because of our age structure. One of the little pie charts that I made for you shows the distribution of people who are both eligible to vote and ineligible to vote based on citizen voting age population. The number of children in Texas who are ineligible to vote is 2.5 times the number of people who are ineligible because they're not yet U.S. citizens. So what would primarily hit the Latino community the hardest would be the exclusion of children.
Go ahead and turn to Michael. If you could talk a little bit sort of more of a big picture and how apportionment has been used historically in the redistricting process.
Sure. That's a great question, because if you go back to the, let's see, if you go back to the founding of the nation, you back to the very beginning, you have a revolution that is fought over what? It's not an equally weighted vote. You have a revolution that's fought over representation. And at the time, in England, you had rotten boroughs that had almost no people. You had whole communities that had very many people that didn't have a seat at the table. And what was important to the founders was that communities be represented. And that meant everybody, women, children, men who couldn't vote because they didn't have enough property. Early in the country's history, there is a clear distinction between voting and representation. And really, when the states early on apportioned, they did it to ensure representation. And so, two trends really emerge through our history. One is that states early on started using population to apportion. Now, they oftentimes also said things like every county should at least have one seat, but they use population in drawing districts. And the other trend really is that states have uniformly disfavored using voter-based apportionment. A few states did, but after the Civil War, that almost dies out, and no more than 5% of legislative chambers were drawn by voters, and there's a good reason for that. Early on, people recognized that women didn't vote, but yet women pay taxes. And what underlies the our country really is the idea of no taxation without representation, and women pay taxes, immigrants pay taxes, children, their parents pay taxes. They use services. And so, and you have a chart in there that shows the number, the number of chambers over time that are drawn different ways. You'll see that states used a lot of different methods, but the one that they really didn't use was voters. And today, every state apportions using some form of total population. A few states exclude non-permanent residents like Hawaii and Kansas, but everybody really uses total population, and there's good reason for that, because that ensures that everybody has a seat at the table. And if you go back to the early one-person, one-vote cases in the 60s, what the problem they were getting at is the situation that you had in California in 1960. In California in 1960, 40% of the population of California lived in one county, Los Angeles County. But because of the way the California Constitution worked, Los Angeles County only had a single senator, one out of 40, in the legislature. So Los Angeles didn't have its weight in the legislature. And in fact, 11% of voters in California controlled a majority of the legislature. And that's really what those cases were getting at, that the one-person, one-vote cases fixed that problem. and states uniformly moved to using total population. It's been accepted. As Vince will talk about, there are lots of good reasons from a data standpoint why you should use total population. But, you know, I guess the key takeaway that I would leave you with is that voters is something that we have rejected almost from the very start of the nation.
And can you talk a little bit about the, you know, the impact of the court's ruling, both in the sense of what the court's different options are in terms of how it could rule, and then how that will affect, you know, there's been some, I've seen some references to the idea that this will affect primarily not only Texas, but with some of the border states, or will the effect be broader than that?
Yeah, Nina hinted at this. I mean, you know, if you move to some form of voter-based apportionment, and it's not clear what you would use to represent voters, but if you used to move to some form of voter-based apportionment, every legislative map in the country would become presumptively unconstitutional and would have to be redrawn. In some states, the changes that would need to be made would be relatively minor, although there would be a cascade effect from that, and so it's they might be actually quite a bit broader than that. In a number of states, the changes would be significant. For example, in Montana, 40% of state house seats are significantly over or underpopulated. That Montana is not a state that you would think that would have these
border.
Yeah, a different border. And Montana is not a state that you would think that would have these problems. But the reason that that happens is, you know, Montana is a state that doesn't have a lot of people. Its population is smaller than Manhattan. Yet it has a fairly large legislature, 100 members in its state house, which means that basically right now there are about 10,000 people per state house district. Well, when you have that few people, one community, say, for example, a Mormon community in southern Montana that has a lot of children, or any community that has a lot of children, that easily throws off the balance of voters and non-voters in the district. And so it's the same in Kentucky. About 38% of state house seats would have to be redrawn in Kentucky. And again, those are not states that you would typically think of. You know, when you read some of the press about this case, people talk about how this is a Latino issue, it's a Texas issue, it's a California or Arizona issue. Really, it is a nationwide issue. And again, you know, redistricting is a little bit like pushing in on a water-filled balloon. You can't really make changes in one part of the map without having, you know, it overflow into other areas. And so really, I think it really gets very, very messy very easily. And I think, you know, if the Evanwell plaintiffs win, we're in for a round of litigation in virtually every state as people try to jockey for advantage. They'll try to figure out which, you know, and they'll try to argue different voter metrics, right? Some people will say we should use citizen voting age population, although that we'll hear that has data problems. Some people will say we should use voters, and there just will be a lot of litigation between now and 2021, and more litigation after 2021 when we redistrict again. So,
okay. Do you have anything else you want to add? Okay, we're going to turn to Vince now, and we are going to draw upon your experiences for 5 years as the director of the Census Bureau. You oversaw the 1980 census. And based on your experience, is it possible to draw districts using voters instead of people?
Well, let me start off by not the census experience, but being on the redistricting commission of the state of California, which I think for the first time in any state, we had a citizens commission who had the total responsibility and authority to create the districts without any intervention on behalf of the legislature. In California, we had 53 congressional districts. When we got done with our job, 20 of those districts were the exact population of 702,905. 12 had a population of 702,906, and 21 achieved a population count of 702,904. So because we had access to very detailed block group level data, the population of the state, we were able to meet the requirements of the Supreme Court that each district would be equal in its size. That also, in the case of our assembly, we were within 95% on each of those, 99.5%. And in the case of the Senate, it was also 99.5% of the actual number. Now, the reason we were able to do this is because we had really access to very detailed data down to the block group level. The census does this count and provides that level of detail. Relative to citizenship or voting age, that data is there, but you can get voting age, but registered voters is a file that the Census Bureau has never collected. And one of the reasons is it's very difficult to get a complete answer from people because you're going to ask if they're registered to vote in the year ending in 10, and then they might be registered to vote in the year ending in 11 or a month after or whenever it might be. So the Bureau is really focused on doing what the Constitution stated its responsibility, and particularly as it related to the amendment, the 14th Amendment, is to count the whole person. And that's what we've done. And I could tell you, both as a provider of information at the Census Bureau and then as a user, as a member of a redistricting commission, if you want to meet the idea of having equal districts, you got to stick with the population count.
And I think you have answered this in your previous response, but just to be clear, the census also does not track citizenship, and if not, why not?
It does count citizenship in the what is called the American Community Survey, which is a census survey conducted by very professional interviewers, because that's a complex question to ask, as are some of the other questions in the American Community Survey. Now, that data is there, but it's a sample of, although it's a pretty good size sample, it's not sufficient to provide that level of data at the block group level. As an example, you know, there would be a difference of several hundred people in sampling error at the block group level. And if you're going to have that big an error, you're not going to get the kind of count equalization that we did in California.
Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.